your career then after you finish your residency there? Where do you go then?
Tulsa, Oklahoma, to start neurological surgery at Hillcrest Hospital.
Why did you pick Tulsa and Hillcrest? Were you invited?
I was invited by a fellow named Herman Flanagan, who was a neurosurgeon here in town, who later went to Little Rock to work at the Veterans Hospital there and then to Augusta, Georgia, now retired. But I joined him in June 61, and I'd finished all my training then.
So you come to Tulsa, Oklahoma, and Hillcrest. Were you putting out the word here that you would like to come in this area?
No, this fellow wrote me. He wrote me and he said, I hear you're finishing up your training there. Why don't you come and join me? I hadn't thought anything about Tulsa, but I said, fine. So I came to Tulsa and joined him and started work in June of 61.
Would we had the number of neurosurgeons in town at that time?
There were five neurosurgeons in Tulsa. I was the sixth.
Can you tell us about some difficult cases?
Well, I recall a family physician at Hillcrest asked me to go by and see a certain patient. Going to the room, I learned this fellow was one of the top executives at Price Pipeline. And he had a whole entourage of people in the room and so on, and I had to invite them to please wait and let me examine him. Upon examining this fellow, I had him undressed in a rather cool room. I could see fasciculations of the muscles. This is a man in his 40s.
What does that mean?
Muscle twitching going on sporadically in the legs, arms, and so on. So I asked him, let me see your tongue. And when I examined his tongue, he had little fasciculations, little worm-like movements in the tongue. He has amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, which is a motor neuron disease and always fatal. So I had to sit down and talk with him and tell him to get everything in order and explain to him what this really is. And he returned about 18 months later and died at Hillcrest. When he came back, you could hardly recognize that this is the gentleman that I'd examined 18 months previously. He'd changed so much, atrophy of the muscles and so on. I recall that case vividly. And I remember Dr. Shapiro saying to me, how in the world did you know what this fellow had? Of course, I had a ward of these at Queen Square. I had 36 people with this disease at Queen Square. And I told him, oh, I went to school, which he enjoyed this. He was a fellow with a great sense of humor.
That was a case where you diagnosed it early on, and there was nothing you could do for him.
There wasn't anything that anybody could do to help, and I might add that there isn't anything anybody can do to this day to help, and that was 1961.
He might have gone on to several doctors, undiagnosed.
Undiagnosed, yes. That's why I wanted the year of diagnostic neurology.
Do you have a case then that was difficult that you thought maybe, I don't know if I can do anything for this person?
Sure. We had an internist named Tom Fair. His second wife was one of the little fortune ladies. He was a friend of mine, and one morning he asked me, would you go by intensive care unit and see this patient? A large man, he said, he's dying. I just want you to see him and confirm everything and talk with his family. I said, sure, sure he will. I went there and examined this man. His name was Virgil Reese. His father was a pediatrician at St. John's Hospital. I went to the bedside and examined this man, large man, almost 300 pounds. He had dilated fixed pupils. He was gasping about 8 times per minute. It was an ominous situation. I then went to talk with his wife and explained he has a large clot in the brain. It's about the size of a baseball and occupies both frontal lobes. I don't think he has long to live. And Dr. Fair has talked with me about this. She said, can you remove the clot? And I said, yes, ma'am, I can remove the clot, but I'm afraid that we're awfully late. We're probably too late. He probably won't recover if I remove the clot. She said, well, if you can remove that clot, I want it removed. So I rang Tom Fair, and he was really nonplussed about all this and said, go ahead, get the clot removed if that's what she wants. So I took him to surgery. Made a bifrontal opening, sort of an ear-to-ear opening behind the hairline, turned a large bifrontal flap, and removed this huge clot. His respirations became normal. His vital signs all became normal. And when Tom Fair came to make rounds the next morning, Virgil Reese said, "Tom, there's no way I can eat Jell-O for breakfast. I have steak and eggs. Would you please tell them?"
Wow.
And Virgil made a complete recovery. He was a stockbroker, and as he left the hospital, he told me, "I've made enough money on the telephone doing stock exchanges to pay my hospital bill and pay you." Fine fella. That was 25 years ago, this operation. He died within the past year or so.
So you saved his life, but his wife saved his life, too.
Actually, she did, because I would not have really recommended the surgery, considering he was just in extremis, dilated fixed pupils and respirations that were labored. Tom Fair had already written on the chart no code blue, meaning no extraneous measures to keep him alive.
How many surgeries do you think you performed in this town?
3,500 craniotomies and 10,000 laminectomies, cervical lumbar, a few thoracic.